Mark's Jesus doesn't beat around the bush. Already within the first chapter of his gospel, Jesus has been introduced by his cousin John the Baptist. He's been driven into the wilderness to face three great temptations at the end of a 40-day fast when he's at his weakest and most vulnerable. And following that, he goes out to pick 12 disciples that will follow him for the next 3 years, and he will teach them his ways. And then he goes to teach in a synagogue as one who has authority, we're told, heals a man with an unclean spirit, and then appears at Simon Peter's house to heal his mother-in-law of a fever. Finally stops long enough to eat, then heals most of the town's people, and then he prays and disappears. But that's the nature of Mark's Jesus. He's a no-nonsense, walking, talking man of action. In fact, the first hint that he's anything but divine comes in today's passage, which tells us that he ate and he had to find a secluded place to retire to pray. It's refreshing to know that even the Son of God had to do things like eat and pray, recharge his own spiritual batteries in order to be effective in ministry for those that he was meeting. But more importantly, Jesus models for us in this brief description of what he starts out to do in chapter 1, for a model for doing ministry in our own time and place that I want to look at with you. It's a fourfold process that begins in the text just before the one that we heard Merrill read to us from. Mark tells us that Jesus was walking along the Sea of Galilee, and he saw Simon and Andrew who were casting their nets into the sea, and Jesus said to them, "Come, follow me, and I will make you of fishers of men and of women." The first act of ministry is one of invitation. He invites others to join him in what he's doing. We need to get into the habit of inviting others to join us, not only for worship, which is wonderful to have everybody here together to celebrate together, but we need to reach out to find what our community's needs are, especially the needs that are not being met, which isn't an easy task. It's a task of differentiating ourselves from everybody else in the community. What is the unique thing that we can offer people that is not being offered in this community? In Jesus' case, it was going out into the community and healing them of diseases and dining with them to show them that rabbis do in fact hang out with ordinary people. You see, the church has to develop an intimacy, has to develop that intimacy that meets people's deepest needs. 12-step groups understand this. They grow by attraction, not by obligation. Nobody goes to a 12-step meeting because they're forced to. They go because they know this is how they're going to stay clean. This is how they're going to be transformed out of an addicted state into a free state. They offer something that the church used to be very good at offering in a clearly focused way that points to something greater than ourselves that can heal us, that can make us whole, and maketh nothing less than a mature, healthy human being. Someone who makes people think of Christ by the way we carry ourselves, with the integrity that we have, with the faith and the doubt that we share, with the honesty that we show to others, with the kind of person whom others look at and say, truly that was a son or a daughter of God. For this to happen, time is required. It doesn't do much good, for example, to invest 100 hours into a person, but do it in 1 hour weekly increments over the span of years. You might learn a lot about somebody that way over time, eventually, but it will be a kind of a shallow knowledge. It won't be that deep. It's kind of like skipping a stone across a lake. If you've ever done that, you know how it just hits the surface and then takes off again. It doesn't go deep until it completely sinks. To know a person, therefore, requires time. It requires an investment of our time, both in private with one another, where we can share who we are, or in small groups, where we can let down our masks, where we can become who we truly are with one another. It requires being around each other enough to see each other cry, to see each other laugh, to care for one another through these times, to see that our mission forward to those that are not yet here is still our mission tomorrow. And when you calculate the hours that we have in a week, 7 days, 24 hours a day, that adds up to 168 hours we have at our disposal each and every week. But how many hours a week do we spend together? How many hours? Maybe one, maybe two? So we have to become intentional about creating time. It's not something that just will happen because we are so frenetic in this part of the country, especially. We're dashing to and fro all over the place. So one of the other things Jesus models for us is the need to center ourselves, to pray, to ask for a clear focus on ways to attract those who have never been in church or those who have been burned by bad church. Folks, there are bad churches out there that will abuse you. Not all churches are equal. Not all churches are the same. So we have to demonstrate the love of Christ whenever we get together, and that takes intentionality and time. We have to learn from Jesus that he went out to where the people were. He met them in their communities, in their homes, in their synagogues, in their towns, and he met their immediate needs. He healed them first and foremost. He then taught them a new way of looking at God that wasn't one of just, I'm going to squash you because you're a sinner. He ate with people. He dined with them. He prayed with them. He shared where they lived and worked and their sorrows and their joys. Personal invitation involvement in other people's lives is what Jesus models for us, and that's what we need to model as well. We need to be intentionally involved in people's lives, making them better. But to be a model, you yourself, as a disciple, must also be in training. Discipleship is never something that you completely arrive at. It's something that you continually have to work on for the rest of your life. When Jesus says, make disciples of all nations, he's setting out our marching orders. He's saying, this is the goal. I want the entire world to know what God is like. Make disciples of all nations. That takes a lifetime to develop that. To disciple someone means to be an apprentice. They're an apprentice to you. The way we used to do in medical school or law school, people would come and study with a barrister or with a doctor, and they would learn the trade by watching the master do what they wanted to learn to do. We need to do that with discipleship. He's given us our goal. We know what it is. It's to transform nothing less than the entire world. To disciple somebody means to not only apprentice them, but also to be a reciprocal student with them. In other words, it's not a one-way street. Teaching also requires listening and learning. The student becomes the teacher becomes the student. It's a fluid thing. Shepherd needs sheep, sheep need shepherds. A relationship develops that's fluid, where leadership moves back and forth as the needs of the couple, the needs of the congregation move back and forth. In short, we learn from each other with Jesus as our guide. We learn how to love each other the way Jesus loved us through one another, learning about our needs. The second thing that Jesus models for us is a sense of community, the importance of not being isolated. Jesus goes to the synagogue to teach, Mark tells us, which means that he shared not only in the daily lives of the people throughout the rest of the 7 days of the week, but in their spiritual and religious lives as well. He went to where they gathered for a common purpose. But because there are many interpretations of who God is, he went in to say, the God I know is like this. You have heard it said, but I say to you that God is loving. You have heard it said, but I say to you, God is just. And he went out to demonstrate that through his actions. He was willing to put people ahead of religious ritual. Ritual never got in the way of a need that he saw. So he heals on the Sabbath to show us one simple truth. Sunday or Saturday, whatever your Sabbath day is, was made for you, not the other way around. It's not so that you have another thing you have to do. It's so that you have one less thing that you have to do every week, other than just to recreate yourself. It's a wonderful thing, this community. But it is found in service, always in service, not the other way around. We're not here to serve ourselves. We're here to get filled up. We're here to get our batteries recharged. And then we're to go out and do ministry. The reason that worship, therefore, is important is because it's one of the few times that we gather together as a community, as a whole, to hear what comes from beyond us, to hear a word that does not come to us as reported by the nightly news, or by what we talk about in the office around the water coolers, or even in most homes. It is here, in this time and place, that we learn about life and about what God intends for our lives to be, so that we will experience an abundance of it. The promise is that as we follow Christ, our lives will become fuller and more meaningful. It is also a promise that we will find a peace that passes all understanding, especially the understanding that the world has of what makes for peace. Peace, the absence of worry, the ability to ride above the stress, not because you have conquered it. You can't conquer stress. You can't conquer fatigue. You can't conquer any of the things that wear you down. But what you can learn to do is to ride above it like a surfer in the curve of a wave. You can use the energy that's there to give you the ride of your life rather than to be swallowed up by it. The third thing that Jesus models for us is extending acts of compassion. Everywhere he goes, he's looking to see what he can do to help make the situation better. In whatever situation he finds himself, whether it's a wedding in Cana where they're running out of wine, and his mom says to him, "Hey, man, this is the perfect time to use some of that God-given power of yours. Let's turn some of this wine into a lot of great, some of this water into great wine." And he does it. That's the first miracle in John's gospel. And others, he goes into the synagogue and sees a woman who's bent over and is in pain while everybody else is praying to God. And what does he do? Instead of praying to God, he goes, heals the woman. That's his prayer to make her whole. So extending acts of compassion is what Jesus does wherever he goes. He looks for ways to serve others. We may not be able to cast out demons like he did or touch someone and have their fever immediately break, though we can do these things, he assures us. But we can do what his mother-in-law, Simon's mother-in-law, did, which is we can serve others. What did she do after she was healed? She offered them a meal. She fed them. She gave them the best she had out of what her gifts entailed. And that's what Jesus calls us to imitate. And it may be something like as simple as giving a meal or a phone call or a visit or an email or a friendship sunshine letter that we send. It can be that simple, but it is reaching out of ourselves, getting out of ourselves to care about somebody else that we don't even know. With a smile, with a laugh, with an honest question, with patience, to just listen. If there's no room in your life for service, then your life will become empty. I can promise you that. We have a natural tendency to want to care for other people. It is what God put in us. And when we refuse that impulse, when we do not let that impulse flourish, we hurt ourselves primarily, and we begin to die. And you see this in people who become isolated, and they become angry, and they just, you know, life is over as far as I'm concerned for them. They're just bitter. They're just making time pass until they kind of kick off this mortal coil. That's not what Jesus is talking about. He's talking about you will have life as you get amongst one another and as you interact with one another. That's where life is to be found. Go out, as Bob Dylan says, I'm going to get up and get out of myself and go out and see what others need. That's what I'm going to do. When I'm focused on myself, it's time to get out. It's time to get out of myself. The fourth thing that Jesus models, the last thing he models for us here in this chapter, is a need that we often overlook, which is to find places of solitude, especially in nature. How many of us actually ever get outside and spend time in parks or amongst the creation that God has given us? And if you don't do that, if you're never out and about in nature, in solitude with God that way, it'll be very hard to ever appreciate how the patterns of life all come together. You have to see it with your own eyes. You have to see how things are interwoven and interconnected to appreciate how beautifully balanced the creation really is. And that's why we need to find places of solitude where we can be alone in prayer with God, just to let your mind drift, to to let God come in and fill it with whatever he wants to fill it with. Martin Luther, the great reformer, once remarked that the busier his day was, the more he needed to spend time in prayer. So if he had a longer day, he spent more time in prayer, not less. We often go the other way, though, don't we? If we have a lot to do, a lot of busy stuff that we got to get done, we kind of cut out anything that we consider to be a waste of time, like just sitting still. And our days become busier and busier as a result, and we just don't have any time. But I can tell you from my own personal experience that time is truly relative. Einstein was absolutely right. Time is always relative. And you will find that if you make time to allow God to recreate you, you will have the necessary time to do what you need to get done. I promise you that. Time is relative. As I get older, time goes faster. Right? When I was young, waiting for Christmas was like 5 years. Now it feels like a week. That's how fast life picks up. And I find also that the more I can give, the more I do reap back in many wonderful ways. In fact, the busier my day is or week looks like, the more time I need to be giving up to God. I mean, really be saying, all right, guide me right now, man, because I don't know what the rest of the day is going to be, and it's going to be so busy, but you know, and I don't even have the language to articulate how crazy it's going to be, so please guide me. When I practice this spiritual discipline, it really works, and I find that I do not burn out. I do not burn out. I do not get anxious or angry when things do not go my way, because I am more aware that the plan that is unfolding now before me is something that's being given to me by God. Right? I had a professor named Koshi Koyama at Union Theological Seminary who was a survivor of the Hiroshima atomic bomb blast. So when he speaks from an experience that few of us have ever had. And he used to tell us that God travels at 3 miles per hour. And I would ask, as everybody else would, why do you say that, Dr. Koyama? And he'd say, that's the speed at which a human being walks. And what he was saying was that we get caught up rushing around all the time in our busyness of our lives. Often that leads us to rush away from God, because God is not in a hurry. God has eternity. God has forever. To God, time is irrelevant. We don't have that luxury, do we? Only God does. So God is waiting upon us. God is not forcing us. God is not going to make us, but God is going to wait on us. He's got all the time in the world. We tend to think of spending alone time as kind of a waste of time, but you are never, ever wasting time when you are spending it alone, recreating yourself with God. In fact, one of my favorite lines in Scripture comes from the psalmist where he says, "Be still and know that I am God." Just be still. That's all you have to do. Prayer keeps us from burning out, and it keeps us from confusing my will with God's will. You know, I might have a nice idea where we should go and how we should get there, but if it's not from God, then I hope I'm smart enough and open enough with eyes to see, as Jesus says, and ears to hear, Jesus shutting the door or the window and directing me in a new way. And I am more likely to do that when I have centered myself. Right? In all areas of life, this applies. Whom you're going to marry, what house you're going to buy, what college you're going to go to, what job should I look for? All of it. Bring it to God. And the last thing that Jesus models for us in our text is the need to pass on what we have learned on our life's journey about the nature of faith, hope, love, loss, rejection, and resurrection. All of this we are to pass on to other people. We are to train our young people, but each other too, because we need training too. We never outgrow it. We need to train each other and our children in the ways of God, to teach them about a loving God, to teach them about a compassionate God, to teach them about a God who cares more about people and the creation than anything we create, than any edifice that we build. It's us that matter to God. It's those folks and us and everything that God has given life to that we are to take care of. because that's how life really is. One generation passing on the lessons that has learned to another generation, but also learning to let go, right? I mean, I've seen people who cannot let the next generation take charge because they're not going to do it the way I did it. Right, they're not going to do it the way I did it. They're a different person than I am. But I have to trust that that same spirit that worked in me is working in them. And that I have to be able to say, it is your time now to be a leader. It is your time now to rise up, as Moses had to say to Joshua, as Elijah had to say to Elisha, as Jesus had to say to Peter, will you care for my sheep, Peter? Well, of course, Lord. Will you feed them? Well, of course you will. Will you love them? You know I do, Lord. Then feed my sheep. Then feed my sheep. Then feed my sheep. Do what I've commanded you. That's what he asks. That's ultimately what we need to do, right? If we want to be a place that's thriving, not just surviving, but thriving, a place that people want to come to because here real life issues are dealt with, real concerns are lifted up. People do not stay the same as when they came in. They go out different. They go out transformed. If we want to be like that, then this is the model. This is what we have to do. We need to leave this place better than we found it. We need to do as Paul says, I planted, Apollos, he came after me, well, he watered, but it was God who gave growth. Each one of us is in a building project. Each one of us is laying a brick into the building of the kingdom of God. Each one of us has a part to play, and if you're not playing your part, nobody else is going to, right? You're unique that way. It's a model that has worked pretty well for 2,000 years, and it is a model that has worked here for the past 180. Let's make sure that model does not end with us. Amen. Oh,